Those patients, they have something that we call Hodgkin's lymphoma or Hodgkin disease, which is a very separate clinical entity and pathological entity that has different, behavior and clinical prognosis. Non-Hodgkin lymphomas, you know, which represent the majority of the patients that we see in practice, they can be further devised based on the cell that originated the cancer, you know, and that has to do with how the immune system matures and develops inside you. So we tend to have lymphomas which are considered T-cell of origin, and there are some other lymphomas that they come from the B-cell repertoire, which are B-cell lymphomas. And in general, you know, 80% of the cases that we see in the United States are actually B-cell lymphomas. They're by far more common, and for the most part, they have a better prognosis. And again, as we're going to be describing during the next couple of slides, each of those two families, they have a significant number of lymphomas. You know, we recognize at least 14 different type of T-cell lymphomas, and at least, you know, 61 different type of B-cell lymphomas. So the skill of taking care of these patients and to understand the disease is to really study each subtype of lymphomas. And today I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about the most common ones or the most challenging ones, you know. So just like when you were talking about, you know, leukemias or MDS, you know, lymphomas, again, are cancers that they are originating within what we call the lymphocytes. The lymphocytes are a subtype of white cells, you know, that basically is responsible for the maintenance and the development of your immune system. Technically, the development of your immune system starts with a stem cell, which is normally located in the bone marrow. That particular stem cell can give birth to either myeloid precursors or lymphoid precursors. The myeloid precursors, for the most part, when they get mutated or they get disturbed, patients end up developing myeloproliferative disorders like acute myelogenous leukemias. Then the lymphoid cells, you know, it's very interesting because for the most part, they originate from stem cells in the bone marrow. But under normal development of your immune system, these cells will travel from the bone marrow into the blood, into the lymph nodes. And the lymph nodes are basically a very important part of your immune system because in the lymph nodes, that's where these particular cells will mature and they will learn to fight infections or they will learn to patrol your body so you don't develop cancer. In addition to the lymph nodes, there are other areas or organs in your body in which these cells will mature and will proliferate, like the thymus gland or the spleen, which for practical purposes are just big lymph nodes. And they're very important during the childhood, you know, during the development of the immune system. Once you turn 20, the function of the thymus and the spleen, in contrast to the lymph nodes, is actually less important, and those organs eventually disappear or they become atrophic, so to say. But, you know, we do recognize, you know, that in order for your immune system to recognize infections or to recognize cancer cells, you know, they need to go to a process of education, you know, in which those cells have different genetic alterations in their genomic, you know, content that will allow them to either differentiate into B cells, T cells, and each of those cells will be able to eventually learn to fight a very specific type of infection or a very specific type of problem, so to say. So we know that those particular lymphoid stem cells, they will develop into what we call B cells or T cells. And again, those B cells or T cell stem cells, you know, they had to give birth to a different number of B cells or T cells. And in this particular cartoon, you can see what are the steps on the maturation process of a B cell and a T cell. And again, if you look at the B cell, you know, the stem cell B cell eventually has to give birth to a mature B cell that is able to fight infections by producing antibodies. And that particular cell is known as plasma cell. That's the end stage of the differentiation process, you know. Now, in your body, you have all of these type of cells located in different areas in your bone marrow or in your lymph nodes, you know. And eventually they go into the tissues when they need to do their work, you know. Same thing happened with T cells. You know, T cells, stem cells, which while they're in the marrow, eventually they will travel into the thymus, you know, and they will become mature T cells. Those mature T cells can become either T cells or they can become NK cells. And these T cells or NK cells are in somehow on charge of one, attacking directly pathogens that you get exposed on a daily basis, or they actually can attack the pathogen, work with what we call antigen-presenting cells, and eventually stimulate the B cells to fight infections. So these are kind of the normal functions of your lymphocytes, so to say, in a very simplistic way, you know. Now, it's very interesting because every T cell or every B cell or every NK cell that you have in your body, they will all come from one single stem cell, so to say. And all of these cells will have a maturation process in which they have each T cell or each B cell will have to learn to fight one specific infection. You know, meaning that in your body you have B cells or T cells who are genetically programmed to fight measles or to fight the flu or to fight, you know, throat infections or, you know. And, you know, something that is very interesting about learning how the immune system matures in your body is to try to figure out, well, how can you store all these genetic variations inside, you know, one set of 23 pairs of chromosomes, you know. And this is one of the big mysteries on the development of the immune system. That's something that we call genetic editing. How do these cells, they actually alter the same set of chromosomes to create a diversified population of cells that they are genetically engineered to fight a very specific type of infection or problem. So in order to do that, you know, B cells or T cells, they go into what we call genetic or somatic hypermutation, in the sense that in order to produce a mature T cell or a B cell that will fight an infection, they have to rearrange certain chromosomes to produce a very specific receptor that will allow that cell to recognize an infection and fight it, you know, whether you're a T cell or a B cell. And in order to do that, every cell has the same kind of set of genes. But the way that each one rearranges the gene, you know, will lead to a different protein. You know, so you start with the same kind of set of genes, but you're able to splice the gene and rearrange it in a different way, you're going to have different forms of combinations of eventually an RNA that will transcribe a different protein. And that's kind of the way that you can diversify your immune system with a very small amount of DNA. So it is because of this, capacity of the immune system to be able to really produce a great variation of normal cells with a very small amount of genetic material, you know, it also unfortunately put these cells at risk to develop mutations as they are maturing and therefore to turn into cancer cells. So understanding how the genes are rearranged and split during the process of the maturation of the lymphocytes has allowed doctors to understand why patients develop one type of lymphoma versus the other one. And this is just kind of, you know, an example cartoon of how that happens. So we use this particular, this is certainly a chromosome that technically has all the information that you need to produce what we call either immunoglobulins or T cell receptors. And those are the ones that are going to be engaging against the pathogens. So by splicing your content and realigning it, you create different type of RNA that in each particular T cell will lead to a very different receptor. But again, this constant breaking and mutating your DNA can lead to development of malignancies, and that's what happened in patients with lymphomas. So when we look at, you know, B cells, as they are developing normally, you know, part of the maturation process is to acquire receptors that allow them to fight infections or to fight things, you know, and that allows pathologists to classify normal or malignant lymphocytes into different subtypes based on the kind of proteins that they express. So one of the tools that we use as clinicians to classify lymphomas is to look at the patterns of receptors that these cancer cells express, because that can tell us a little bit about the biology of the lymphomas. So these are certainly certain what we call cluster-designated proteins. These are basically CD receptors. The ones that they are kind of highlight here, they are primarily present in B cells and not present in T cells, okay? And you can see that as the cell goes from a very primitive cell that is not capable to fight infections to a fully trained, you know, plasma cell, you can see that these cells will either gain some proteins or will lose other ones, okay? The abnormal gain or loss of proteins during that process of maturation can be a signal that we can use to differentiate cancer cells versus normal cells. Now, this is a cartoon in which, as I told you before, we know that these cells are supposed to mature, and they mature or they grow in different compartments of the immune system, either the bone marrow with the very primitive cells or in the lymph nodes as the cells are maturing. Depending on where a mutation occurs that turns this normal cell into a cancer cell will be the type of B cell lymphoma that you may encounter in clinical practice, you know? So we know that the more aggressive lymphomas, they normally occur from the precursors in the bone marrow. And again, you know, certainly the kind of slower lymphomas, so to say, you know, they will occur at end, in the end stage of differentiation. That's just a very generic term, because in reality, there are many patterns of clinical behavior. The same thing happened in T cells. And I want to highlight, because this is very important, when we're trying to differentiate between T cells or B cells, you will find out that for the most part, cluster-designated antigens, that they are in single digits, they belong to T cells. Cluster-designated antigens that are in two digits, for the most part, they are part of the B cells. So it's a very quite a quick, easy way to memorize them. But again, it's kind of similar. As you develop your, as your T cells mature and are able to fight things, they will gain or lose some receptors. And the presence of these receptors, they can be actually tested and identified in biopsy material. So we can actually tell what is affecting a patient with a suspected lymphoma. And again, this is kind of similar. And we'll, you know, depending on the maturation process, you know, and depending on what cell is the one that is mutated, is the type of lymphomas that you will have. So I'm trying to highlight again how complex is the, you know, the biology of lymphomas, because each of one of these type of lymphomas, whether you are B cell or T cells, they are driven by different mutations, and they behave clinically very differently, and each one has different kind of treatments, and the treatments do evolve with time. So it's kind of highlight that in contrast to acute leukemias or other hematological cancers, lymphomas are indeed a very complex group of cancers. And the success in treating these patients really relies in understanding the biology of just each particular subtype. So when we see a patient that is diagnosed with a lymphoma or that we think has a lymphoma, that particular patient normally comes to your office because they have an enlarged lymphoid gland. And again, the first thing that you think is, well, what can it be? In general, infections are more common than cancer. So the majority of the people that come to see you with swelling glands, they don't have a lymphoma, they have an infection, you know? But, you know, again, because we work in a cancer center, it happens the opposite here, because we get patients referred to us once they have the lymphoma. But when a patient has a lymph node that is either too big, and when I'm talking too big, it's something about more than 4 or 5 centimeters, or if the patient has a swelling gland that has lasted for more than 2 weeks after antibiotics, normally it's recommended to get a biopsy to see why that lymph node has not regressed. You know, sometimes lymph nodes can increase in size if the normal cells are being exposed to a bacteria or a virus, and they're supposed to grow to fight it. That's plain and simple. And when you clear the infection, the lymph node size will go down. There are some chronic viral infections that can lead to chronic enlargement of lymph nodes, like HIV infection, you know. And that's very common, that those patients normally they have enlarged lymph glands, but they don't have cancer. So anyway, so once you think that the patient may have a lymphoma, the first thing is to get a biopsy. And this is what the biopsy of a lymph node will look like, okay? Normally, this is, you will kind of look at different things. You will see these kind of round areas here. This is something that we call the follicles. This is kind of like the minuscule areas where the lymphocytes, the B cells, are gonna go there to train, okay? And if you see, you have this kind of like a blue area here. That area is what we call the marginal zone of each follicle. So that's when you have a very specific type of B cell that has not been exposed yet to an antigen, but is kind of ready to start the maturation process to become a plasma cell. And then you have the germinal center, which is the center of the follicle. That is where the cells are being trained to recognize infections, and that's where doing all this mutation that I was explaining earlier. And then in between the follicles, you have these kind of areas here. Those are usually T cells or dendritic cells. These are the T cells or the dendritic cells that are supposed to further help the B cells to mature and become plasma cells. So, this is a normal lymph node, but in reality, when you have a patient that develops a lymphoma, you know, and I'm not a pathologist, so, but, you know, normally the pathologist will look at the architecture of the lymph node gland, and it will say if it's preserved or if it's broken. Because when you have a lymphoma, you will see a destruction of this pattern. You will see either an increase in the cells in between the follicles, because there could be T cell lymphomas, or you will see an expansion of the blue ones, if you have marginal cell lymphomas or mantle cell lymphomas, or you will see a really heavy proliferation of the cells in the germinal centers. Each of these type of cells have different markers that you can test by immunohistochemistry. Remember the cluster-designated antigens that I was mentioning early. So depending on the pattern of the architecture, and depending on the protein markers of the biopsy material, doctors can tell what type of lymphoma a patient may have. So in reality, this is the first steps that we do to establish whether a patient has a lymphoma or not. There are additional steps that now we're doing to fine-tune the treatment of patients, and those testings are primarily genetic testing, looking for karyotype abnormalities or genetic imbalance that can be present more commonly in different subtype of lymphomas. So, as I said before, when we have a patient that comes with a lymph node, it is very important that the patient is seeing an oncologist who has some interest in lymphomas, and that particular person has to talk to a surgeon or a radiologist to get a proper tissue. In contrast to other type of cancers, you know, in lymphomas, obtaining adequate tissue is the first step in your treatment algorithm, and is really kind of what makes the difference between a successful treatment or not. So we always stress the need to get proper diagnosis. And in order to get an accurate diagnosis, you need to have adequate tissue. So there are many types of ways to do biopsies or to obtain tissues. Some of them require what we call removing a biopsy, and other ones require doing what we call fine needle biopsies, you know. At the same time, you know, not only you need to get a proper tissue, you also need to start looking at the entire immune system of the patient so you can see exactly where the cancer is nesting, you know. Just because you feel one lymph node in the neck of a patient that is enlarged doesn't mean that the cancer may be located in one area. A lot of times, that's just the tip of the iceberg. So, It is very important that we communicate with radiologists as well as with surgeons to try to get the proper diagnosis. And the most important thing is that when we look at biopsies, for the most part, we prefer to remove an entire lymph node that is abnormally enlarged so we can store it. The bigger amount of tissue, the better. If, you know, situations does not allow, because if the patient is too sick or is too old, sometimes we can settle for what we call a core biopsy. In general, biopsies with small needles are not good enough to get adequate diagnosis, and usually we don't use them. And again, based on how the cells look under the microscope, based on the presence or not of a specific cluster-designated antigens, you know, we can then classify the patient in a T-cell or a B-cell lineage. And again, additional genetic abnormalities that are going to be talking down the road will help us in better treat patients. So this is just, again, some of the basic things that we need to do to diagnose the patient with lymphoma. And again, you know, just pretending that, you know, when we look at a patient that came initially to us, when you look at the biopsy, you know, when we look at the microscope, a very quick way to do first, if we suspect it's a lymphoma, we look at the size of the cells. Are the cells big or are the cells small? For the most part, most of the aggressive lymphomas, they have big cells. And for the most part, with some exceptions, the lymphoma that they have is small cells, they actually are slow growing and less dangerous, so to say. But in reality, you know, we do depend on these particular markers to try to establish the type of lymphoma that you are facing, you know. Now, those markers, you know, not only allow us to differentiate lymphomas, you know, but are also allowing us to develop therapies that we can use to target these cancer cells. This is a cartoon that just highlights different receptors that are present in different type of lymphomas. And, you know, we use those receptors to diagnose these patients, but at the same time, there's a lot of antibodies which are being generated now. Some of them are in preclinical testing, some of them are in clinical trials, and some of them are actually approved by the FDA that we're using to treat patients with different types of lymphomas. And the most common one are the antibodies that they're bound to CD20. CD20 is a marker of B-cell lineage, okay? So what I want to focus now a little bit is about, and you know, how are we managing first B-cell lymphomas, and then how are we going to be managing T-cell lymphomas. So B-cell lymphomas are by far more common, you know. For the most part, B-cell lymphomas, you know, they originate in the, you know, in the lymph nodes, you know. And again, you know, they exhibit B-cell markers. So most of the B-cell lymphomas will express CD20. And again, CD20, for the most part, is a transmembrane protein that has four intercellular and transmembrane domains. It doesn't have a clear function. It's thought to be a calcium channel, but in reality, it doesn't have any enzymatic domain in the intercellular domain of the protein. We know that it's not necessary for maintaining a normal B-cell function because knockdown studies of CD20 in animal experiments had failed to produce any lethality. So we know that animals can live without CD20, but we know that it's a marker that is present in the entire maturation process of B cells, you know. Now, because it's present in at least 80% of B cell lymphomas, you know, it has been a very important kind of antigen to target in terms of drug development. So there is now at least three antibodies against CD20 that have been approved by the FDA to treat lymphomas. The most used one is rituximab, which is a chimeric antibody that has a variable region that is of murine origin that bounds to the receptor and has a constant region that is actually of human content that, you know, in somehow mediates the biological effects of the antibody. When the antibody bounds the lymphoma cells, it activates the complement by the classical pathway to lyse the cancer cells. It attracts effector cells like natural killer cells or neutrophils and induce what we call antibody-dependent cell cytotoxicity. Or, for reasons that we don't know, when the antibody bound CD20, there is a change in the calcium contents intracellularly as cells tend to go to apoptosis. Now, CD20 is actually very important because, as you can see, and I kind of explained to you, is being seen during the entire maturation process of B cells. And again, these are actually a very diverse type of lymphomas that they are known to express CD20, with the exception of multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the plasma cells, it's at the end stage of the differentiation process. And again, most of these type of lymphomas that we have here, they are the ones that are originating within the germinal center of the lymph nodes, you know. And again, you know, what you can see, what is common is that all of these lymphomas, they do express CD20, okay? Because of that, Rituxan was and has been tested in every type of lymphoma that expressed the receptor, and it actually has been shown to be active, you know. It actually has been able to improve the cure rates of patients with lymphomas. As I said before, you know, the way that we approach patients with lymphoma depends on the type of lymphoma that they have. So we have at least 85 different type of lymphomas. So again, for the time of the lecture, I just wanted to focus in a couple of them. So just to highlight the challenges that we see and where the field is changing, you know. But we always invite anyone to spend time in our program, whether in our laboratory program or in our clinics, because you can see exactly how difficult or how diverse is the way that we treat these patients. So diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is by far the most common type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that we see in the United States. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to highlight it here. It is a lymphoma that is basically is lethal, but is curable. And again, with current standard treatments, we're expecting to cure at least 65% of the patients with large B-cell lymphomas. This is a very busy table, but it's just a table that highlights that adding Rituxan to chemotherapy was able to improve the cure rates of patients with this type of cancer. You know, there were 4 clinical trials conducted in Europe or in America, and they were looking at adding Rituxan to standard polychemotherapy treatments. You know, and in every single trial, adding the Rituxan to the chemotherapy, it was able to double the amount of patients being cured from the cancer. And it was based on these 4 clinical trials that now we're using Rituxan in combination with chemotherapy for these kind of patients. So prior to Rituxan, the cure rate of patients with large cell lymphoma was around 35%. Now, the problem is, and this is something that is trying to stress the need to understand better large cell lymphomas, is that while we are curing more patients, when the cancer comes back, it's very hard to cure them. So yes, we cure 65%, but the 35 that we couldn't cure, they tend to be more resistant than in the past. And that has to do with what I call the loss of evolution. If you change the conditions in which a cancer cell is living, the ones who survive are going to be better in adapting. You know? So this is actually data that came from a clinical trial looking at patients who they have large cell lymphoma that they had either got Rituxan or CHOP chemotherapy and the cancer came back. And then the patients were given a second cocktail of chemotherapy drugs with the hope that they were going to cure them. And the patients went to receive different type of chemotherapy regimens. Really, for this class, it doesn't matter to know the type of drugs, you know. But what is very important to notice is that the patients that they were relapsing after getting CHOP chemotherapy alone, they tend to respond better to the treatment. But the patients who the cancer was growing after the Rituxan chemotherapy combination, they were more resistant to the second round of chemo. And this is what you can see in the survival probabilities. Patients who they had prior Rituxan exposure, they tend to do worse compared to the ones who they didn't. Now, doesn't mean that we're going to stop using Rituxan. No, Rituxan is curing more patients. But what is highlighting is that if you have a lymphoma, a large cell lymphoma, that is failing current therapies now, they have a really poor outcome, and we need to find out why, you know. and we had to try to develop new therapies for them. So a lot of doctors were trying to figure out, well, you know, we need to cure more patients. So what about if we do more chemo? Let's just add more chemotherapy. So there's a lot of clinical trials that were done over 10 years that they were trying to add more and more chemotherapy to try to cure more patients. But all these trials were pretty much negative. So adding chemotherapy without any scientific rationale of understanding the disease, it didn't lead to any gains in curing more patients. We just exposed patients to more side effects. So one of the areas that we have been very active in studying is to try to figure out what patients we can cure with standard chemo and Rituxan, and which patients we can't. And of the patients that we can't, what are really, at the cellular level, the things that make them more resistant? And can we actually develop a drug to attack them? And that's basically what has been done, well, we have been doing for the last 5 years. So there was a big project in the United States that they were trying to look at patterns of gene expression in patients with large cell lymphomas. And this particular project was primarily in Stanford and the NIH. And they were basically able to look at hundreds of patients with large cell lymphomas. And they were able to divide them in three distinct groups based on genetic studies, in what we call gene expression profiles. And these three different type of lymphomas, or variants of large cell lymphomas, so to say, they had different pathogenesis, and they actually had different responses to treatment. So now we recognize that large cell lymphoma is no longer one type of lymphoma, but in reality there are three subtypes. Activated B-cell lymphomas, germinal center lymphomas, and what we call primary mediastinal lymphomas. Why they're different? Because the cure rate is different. When you look at patients with activated B-cell lymphomas, really the cure rate with the standard chemo is around 40-45%. When you have a germinal center lymphoma, you treat them with the same chemo, your cure rate is much higher. And the primary mediastinal lymphomas, who they are treated with a similar regimen, just slightly, just a couple of tweaks, the cure rate is pretty much 100%. So in reality, you know, this particular type of patients is a group that deserve more attention. And this is something that we have been doing for the last couple of years. So what makes them different? And again, there have been a lot of studies trying to understand what cellular pathways are more relevant in each subtype of lymphomas. So this particular table kind of highlight some of the driving forces of these lymphomas. We know that germinal center lymphomas, for the most part, are driven by aberrations in either suppression of p53 by BCL6 or by dysregulation of the apoptotic process by genetic aberrations in what we call the BCL2 family members. And again, you know, attacking the BCL2 family proteins can be a potential strategy to attack these cancers. The activated B-cell lymphomas are usually characterized by an increase in NF-kappa B activity that leads to actually a higher proliferation rate and a higher degree of chemotherapy resistance. There has been at least three different ways that we can now use to downregulate NF-kappa B activity in these lymphomas and improving clinical outcomes. And finally, primary mediastinal B-cell lymphomas that are again characterized by NF-kappa B activation, but for the most part is driven by actually JAK2 mutations. And again, currently, there are actually several JAK2 inhibitors that people are trying to test in patients with primary mediastinal lymphomas. Now, the only setback here is that we cure every patient with chemotherapy. So in reality, the need for these agents is not as important, so to say, as drugs for patients with activated B-cell lymphomas. So, certainly, this particular classification of lymphoma was based on gene expression profiling, which can be expensive and labor-consuming. It has been streamlined to using immunohistochemistry, so we're able to actually now use it at a large scale, cheaper, using immunohistochemistry instead of gene expression profiling. And again, What we can see here, this is just looking at our experience, which is similar. Patients with the hegemonal center large cell lymphoma, they to do better than the ones who they don't, you know? Now, how can we target the bad lymphomas? So if we already know that the ABC type of large cell lymphomas are the bad ones, how can we target them? So we have been working for several years in the laboratory looking at different compounds. One of them is a drug that now is known as lenalidomide, or commercially is known as Revlimid. It's an immunomodulatory drug. It's supposed to have anti-angiogenesis properties, but also decrease NF-kappa B activity. We actually look at clinical trials looking at lenalidomide in patients who they had large cell lymphoma that have failed chemotherapy or a bone marrow transplant. And we know that if you have an ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma, you have a higher probabilities to respond to this particular drug alone. This was further confirmed in a randomized clinical trial across the world. And again, several group of doctors, they have been adding lenalidomide to the standard Rituxan CHOP chemotherapy. And again, what we can see by adding this, you know, we can see that, remember in the prior slide, let me just go back here, oops, sorry. If you look at it here, kind of the cure rate of a patient with an ABC is around 40%, 45%, okay? So, oh, sorry. This is the data from the Italian group in which when you look at those patients with ABC, when you add the Rituxan CHOP and you add the lenalidomide, your cure rate at least at 2 years is 81%. So certainly it's kind of lifting those patients up. It doesn't do too much to the germinal center because we never predicted they were going to do anything to it. But it's certainly helping the patients with the germinal center, with the non-germinal center type. Again, this was further confirmed by a group in the Mayo Clinic. And again, they were basically comparing at Rituxan CHOP, that was like historical archive patients. You can see that when you only get the Rituxan CHOP, you're a germinal center lymphoma, you have a higher cure rate than if you have an ABC subtype. But if you actually add Revlimid to the Rituxan CHOP or lenalidomide to the Rituxan CHOP, you actually cure more patients. So what was the kind of the bad players are becoming now the better players. You know? And again, this was based on understanding the biology of the lymphoma, what drives the lymphomas, and try to develop a drug that you can can use to target a very specific type of lymphoma. There are ongoing phase 3 clinical trials. There are two of them that are gonna confirm these findings. But again, this is something that eventually will change the way that we manage patients with lymphoma, with this type of lymphoma. I think in the future, we're gonna be looking at patients where they have large cell lymphoma. And we're gonna be basically, dividing them into germinal center lymphomas, you will get Rituxan CHOP. If you have an ABC large cell lymphoma, you will be getting Rituxan Revlimid CHOP, you know. And again, hoping that we're going to be able to cure more patients. Now, this looks good. Yes, we're curing more patients, but there's still a significant number of patients that we cannot cure. And that has led to look at other genetic alterations that may be relevant. So for several years, we have been looking at c-MYC, which is a transcription factor. It actually stimulates the proliferation of cancer cells. We know that large cell lymphoma that they express c-MYC, they tend to have a worse outcome compared to if you are a negative c-MYC, you know. And again, this is very interesting because there is a very small subset of patients that for many years we couldn't cure with Rituxan CHOP, and those patients are now being identified as patients who they have a double genetic translocation that involves the oncogenes of c-MYC and BCL2. So when you have a large cell lymphoma that has these two genetic aberrations, you know, it's something that we call double hit lymphomas, and they tend to actually develop a resistant disease, and they tend to die if you treat them with the standard therapy. Now, for the last 3 years, we have been actually trying to identify those patients. We know that there are only 8% of the patients with large cell lymphomas, but we know that they are the 8% that we cannot help with the standard chemo. And for the most part, we are treating them with more intense regimens. This is a very complicated slide, but this is basically looking at, when you look at patients where they had the double hit large cell lymphoma, you know, this is only large cell lymphoma patients where they had these two genetic aberrations. When you look at, you know, the cure rate is zero. They all die, you know, over time. If you try to treat them with different chemotherapies, again, this is kind of like a pool analysis of 20 different institutions across the United States, and we participate on it. And we're trying to ask different doctors, well, what do you do with those patients? You know, a lot of doctors were still doing the standard chemo. A lot of other doctors were doing something different. And again, this is basically what the standard chemo gets you. So a lot of doctors are trying to do something more aggressive, you know. This is kind of a better way to see the data because you kind of lump all the rest in one and compare it to the standard treatment. So we know that those patients, you know, they do require a more aggressive chemotherapy. We know that these patients are driven by these two genetic mutations. So currently, there are actually specific inhibitors of BCL2 and c-MYC. We have done a lot of preclinical studies looking at combining both, and again, it seems to be promising. So they're going to be moving eventually into clinical trials. So now, moving forward, and I just want to go quickly over a couple of other type of lymphomas. You know, this is a different type of lymphoma. This is something that we call a mantle cell lymphoma. And this is a very unique pathological and clinical entity that for many years was not actually recognized by pathologists or clinicians. It was basically defined in 1992. And at the beginning, mantle cell lymphomas were classified as slow-growing lymphomas because when you look at the slide, they have small cells. So when I talked about, you know, the very simplistic way to look at lymphomas is where you have small cells or large cells. So for many years, doctors were treating mantle cell lymphomas with therapies that they were primarily designed to treat patients with slow-growing lymphomas. And all the patients, unfortunately, were dying with less than 3 years from diagnosis because the patients were developing very quickly resistant to chemotherapy drugs. Genetic advances in cytogenetics allowed to the identification that this group of patients who were manifested by tumors with small cells that they were very resistant to chemotherapy drugs, they found that these patients, they have a very consistent genetic abnormality that led to the translocation of the chromosome 11 to 14, lead to the upregulation of, you know, cyclin D1, so allow these cells to keep going into the cell cycle, you know. And this is a pathognomonic characteristic of mantle cell lymphomas. So if you don't have this translocation, you cannot be considered a mantle cell lymphoma, and it's a driving force of the disease. Now, technically, this is just kind of a summary that when you look at these type of lymphomas, if you treat them with the standard treatment, most of the patients will die within 1 or 2 years of diagnosis. You know, adding high-dose chemotherapy, adding intense chemotherapy, allow the patients to live longer. But the majority of the patients with mantle cell lymphoma, in contrast to large cell lymphoma, they are not cured. As a matter of fact, mantle cell lymphoma is considered an incurable lymphoma. And with the current available treatments, the median time to survival from diagnosis is around 8 years. 15 years ago, it was only one. So in reality, we are making a significant progress. You know? Now, we know that, you know, the kind of landmark of mantle cell lymphomas is the upregulation of cyclin D1 that allowed these cells just to keep going into the cell cycle. And by doing that, sometimes they develop additional genetic imbalances, like deletions of the ATM gene or deletion of the P53, and that actually allowed these lymphomas to become even more aggressive. So when we look at patients with mantle cell lymphoma now, we actually not only look at the presence of cyclin D1, that is just to establish the diagnosis, but we also look at ATM gene deletions or P53 deletion to further, you know, establish how aggressive these lymphomas can be, you know. Now, as I said before, this is what you get if you treat them with standard chemotherapy. Everyone dies. Now, if you treat them with more aggressive chemotherapy, you are actually gaining some benefit for some patients. And again, you know, this is something that you will see when we take care of patients with lymphomas, we look at each lymphoma differently and we treat them very differently one from the other one, because we want to keep curing more patients, or the one that we cannot cure, to keep them in remission for a very long time. Now, mantle cell lymphomas, they do require a bone marrow transplant. And I think Dr. Cheng is going to talk to you next week about how bone marrow transplant works and what kind of bone marrow transplant we do use in clinical practice. But we know that in mantle cell lymphomas, the timing of the transplant is very important. What you want to do in mantle cell lymphomas is to control the disease for the longer period of time to prevent the emergence of resistance. So by doing the first transplant as part of your first line treatment, they actually yield to a better outcome than if you wait to do the transplant late in the course of the disease of the patients. So in reality, when we look at patients with mantle cell lymphomas, those patients will treat them with very intensive chemotherapy drugs, and then we'll do a bone marrow transplant. So as you know, we're treating them very differently from, diffuse large B-cell lymphomas. Now, I want to switch a little bit, and with this we'll finish, is to another group of lymphomas which they don't get too much attention, but they're quite challenging and very interesting. And this is what we call the T-cell lymphoma groups. T-cell lymphomas, they basically represent only 20% of the patients with lymphomas. And this is just the classification of T-cell lymphomas. And this is based on the clinical presentation. We have lymphomas of T-cell nature that they occur only in the skin. We have the ones who they present with blood involvement or leukemic involvement. Lymphomas that they present with like lymph node masses. And then lymphomas that they originate in other organs like the liver or the gut. Now, these type of clinical presentations, they also have to do with in what moment of the maturation process of the T cell development the mutation occurs. Now, the most common ones that we see in the nodal area are what we call the angiomyoblastic T cell lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphomas, and peripheral T cell lymphoma, otherwise non specified. These are what we call mature T-cell lymphomas. Usually, the ones who they present with leukemic phase are usually immature T-cell lymphomas. Some of them, they get managed by the leukemia service. The skin lymphomas, for the most part, they have a very indolent course. For the most part, most of the problems are cosmetic. But eventually, as the disease progresses in the skin becomes vulnerable to infections, and patients tend to die from infections more than from the lymphoma. And then we have the extranodal sites of lymphoma, which are very, very rare. They're usually related to NK cell cells, so usually NK cell lymphomas or T cell lymphomas with NK cell features. And they usually are lethal. Again, these particular lymphomas, we seldom have anyone surviving more than 2 or 3 years. Now, when we look at T cell lymphomas, I told you before, they only represent 20% of the patients with lymphomas in general. But they are challenging to the doctors because, one, they are very difficult to diagnose. Sometimes physicians take several biopsies to get the diagnosis. Two, pathologists are sometimes not very aware of them, so sometimes they don't do the testing. A lot of times when you see a patient that has a lymphoma and that the lymph node is enlarged, if you do the biopsy, the pathologists, for the most part, usually run a B-cell lymphoma workup because B-cell lymphomas are more common. So you have to somehow communicate with your pathologist if you think that the patient may have a T-cell lymphoma, because the stories that they need to be done, they are very different, So this is a pie that kind of highlights the different histologies of T-cell lymphomas. And again, the most common ones are peripheral T-cell lymphomas and angiomyoblastic T-cell lymphomas. Again, these lymphomas, they tend to be quite aggressive, In general, there are some, when you talk to pathologists, sometimes it's very difficult for the pathologist to classify the patient with T-cell lymphomas. So you will find out that there are some entities that pathologists can actually feel very confident about diagnosing them. And these are the ones who are here, anaplastic large cell lymphomas, angiomyoblastic T-cell lymphomas, and NK cell lymphomas. And then you have a lot of other ones. in which sometimes it takes two or three hematopathologies to actually achieve a consensus and diagnosis. So at our institute, every time that we see a T-cell lymphomas, we do discuss the case with several pathologies, so we actually can narrow the diagnosis and the subtype classification of a T-cell lymphoma case. Now, in general, and this is another way that we classify T-cell lymphomas, you know, we look at the ones where they have leukemic, nodal, or cutaneous. And it is important because this is when we look at the outcomes of these patients. Patients who they have an aplastic large cell lymphoma who they express ALK protein, they tend to do an excellent outcome. Those patients, they get the standard chemotherapy and you don't have to worry about them because you will cure them. But the rest of the patients, you know, they have a very, very aggressive type of disease and they tend to develop resistance to standard chemotherapy. So for the most part, these patients we tend to refer to academic centers like Roswell and we tend to treat them more aggressively. So this survival course that you're seeing is basically looking at outcomes of T-cell lymphomas treated with the standard chemotherapy and not with more aggressive regimen like we're doing now. Again, this is, again, the difference of anaplastic large cell lymphoma ALK negative and peripheral T-cell lymphoma non-specified. Again, that's just kind of telling you that there are very few type of T-cell lymphoma that they respond to standard treatments, and those patients, they need to be referred early to cancer centers for proper management. And again, with this, I wanted to end the talk because I know we can talk forever about different type of lymphomas. But I just wanted to highlight that when it comes to lymphomas, diagnosing the proper type of lymphoma is important. To assess the tumor burden of the patient is important. And now, not only diagnosing the type of lymphoma that the patient has, but understanding the biological, the oncogenic drivers of each lymphoma is leading to better therapies for patients. I do know that, you know, when it comes to lymphomas in general, we tend to either cure a significant number of patients, usually around 70% of them, or if we cannot cure them, we can certainly control the disease for an average of 10 to 15 years. So in reality, the outcomes of patients with lymphomas are much better than other type of hematological malignancies. And sometimes the key of that is basically diagnosing the patient properly, staging the patient properly, and treating the patient with the correct therapy that may lead to a better outcome. And again, you know, so this is kind of an overview of how do we approach lymphomas in general in the clinic, and some examples of what science is contributing to what we're doing to patients now. So, and with this, I would like to stop and take any questions.